Imagine for a second that you are 29 years old, and you realize, just sitting there on a random Tuesday, that you have already completed your life's defining work.
Right, which is just, it's a heavy thought.
It really is.
Yeah.
You are a member of the most famous group of people in human history.
Yep.
I mean, the world literally screams at the sight of you.
Oh, yeah, constantly.
But the machine is broken. The defining chapter of your life is officially over, and you are staring down the barrel of the next 50 years. Like, what on earth do you do tomorrow morning?
Yeah, it is an incredibly daunting premise, you know? We love the fairy tale of reaching the absolute pinnacle of success and just sort of staying there.
Right, to planting your flag on the mountain.
Exactly. But reality rarely allows for a clean, triumphant ending like
It
that.
really doesn't. And that's why we're here. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are so glad you're pulling up a chair and sitting right here at the table with us today.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Because today, based on this really fascinating historical overview by Megan Paces, we are looking at the post-1970 solo careers of the Beatles.
Which is such a rich topic.
Oh, absolutely. But our mission today isn't just to, recite a music history timeline for you. We want to extract the ultimate lesson in forced reinvention.
Right, like how do four completely different human beings process the exact same trauma of losing their shared identity?
Yes, it is the ultimate psychological case study. I mean, the 1970 breakup is legendary,
Of
obvious.
course, but the real insight isn't in the breakup itself, is it?
No, not at all. It's in the why behind the split, and then those wildly divergent paths they sprinted down the second the pressure valve was released.
Yes, sprinted is definitely the right word.
So, okay, let's unpack
Hot
this.
dog.
If we're going to understand those paths, we have to understand the environment first, because the narrative people usually throw around is just, oh, they hated each other and suddenly quit.
Right, which is just not true.
Exactly. It wasn't an explosion. It was this agonizing, slow-motion, 3-year fracture.
A very slow fracture. And to understand how it happened, you really have to look at the catalyst, which was in August 1967.
Right, when their manager, Brian Epstein, tragically died from a drug overdose.
Exactly. Now, it's easy to just think of Epstein as their accountant or their booker or whatever, but Epstein was the glue.
Yeah, he really was.
His true genius was acting as the human buffer for four massive egos. I mean, he let them pursue their musical ideas, but he was always the mediator when inevitable conflicts arose.
So when Epstein died, it wasn't just that they lost their financial guidance, they lost their shock absorber.
Oh, completely.
It kind of makes me think of like a wildly successful startup that tragically loses its founding CEO.
That's a great comparison.
Right. Suddenly, the brilliant creatives, like the engineers and the designers, they are forced into the boardroom to make executive decisions.
And that's exactly what happened. They tried to run this endeavor called Apple Corps, which was originally set up as a tax shelter.
Which is wild in itself.
Yeah, but without Epstein, this tax shelter turned into a sprawling, chaotic business venture. I mean, they were brilliant musicians, but they had absolutely no experience running a corporate empire.
Right. And without Epstein to buffer the personalities, the creative disagreements in the studio suddenly become deeply personal rejections.
Precisely. That's the mechanism that broke the ban.
Because if Paul didn't like George's song, Paul had to look George in the eye and reject him directly.
Exactly. And that creative claustrophobia was just reaching a boiling point. Take George Harrison, for example.
Oh, yeah.
By 1968, he is rapidly maturing as a songwriter. He's actually traveling to Bombay to record his solo album, Wonderwall Music.
Wait, really? He was doing that while still in band?
Yeah, utilizing Indian classical musicians, growing immensely as an artist. But he brings these brilliant new ideas back to the band, and John and Paul routinely dismiss them.
Which has to feel incredibly suffocating. You're discovering your voice, and your best friends are essentially telling you to stay in the background.
It was incredibly frustrating for him.
And on top of that creative frustration, you have these massive, sudden boundary violations happening.
Right, the studio dynamic shifts completely.
Yeah, because in 1968, John starts this intense, consuming relationship with conceptual artist Yoko Ono. And from that point on, they are quite literally always together.
Always, including right in the middle of the recording
Which
studio.
fundamentally broke a very strict tacit agreement between the four of them.
It did. For years, the rule was no wives or girlfriends in the recording sessions. The studio was their sanctuary.
But John didn't just bring Yoko into the room, right? He demanded she have artistic input.
Yes, she would literally make suggestions during their takes. You can imagine the friction this caused, especially with George.
Because George had previously felt this deep spiritual and creative brotherhood with John.
Exactly, over their shared interests in LSD and Indian philosophy, so it felt like a betrayal.
The pressure just keeps compounding until people literally start snapping. I mean, during the recording of the White Album, which Rolling Stone magazine perfectly described as four solo albums under one roof.
Oh, that's such a good description.
Right. Ringo actually quits the band. The atmosphere is so toxic and sour that the most easygoing guy in the room just walks out.
He just leaves the country, goes on holiday to Sardinia for several weeks.
It's crazy. He does eventually come back, though, to find his drum kit entirely covered in flowers.
Yeah, a nice peace offering from George, but the peace doesn't last at all.
No, it doesn't.
Because in early 1969, during the notoriously tense Get Back sessions, George himself quits.
Right. He's just entirely fed up with Paul's patronizing directions and John's total detachment.
Yes, because by this point, John has descended into a severe heroin addiction. So George just packs up and walks out.
And John's reaction to George quitting is to legitimately suggest they just replace him with Eric Clapton.
Which is completely wild to think about.
It really is. But even with all that interpersonal drama, the final nail in the coffin was actually a boardroom war, right?
Yes. This raises an important question about leadership. The business void left by Epstein had to be filled.
And they disagreed on who should fill it.
Violently. Paul fiercely wanted his new in-laws, lawyers Lee and John Eastman, to manage them.
Because to Paul, they represented a safe, traditional corporate approach.
Exactly. But John, George, and Ringo outvoted him. They wanted Alan Klein, a tough-talking, gritty music executive.
And this split the band into two totally adversarial camps.
Right. McCartney later stated that this forced evolution from a brotherhood of musicians into warring businessmen was the central, fatal blow.
Okay, wait, I struggle to understand this transition. Because John Lennon is actually the first one to privately pull the trigger and say, I'm out, in September 1969.
He did. He essentially begged to be free of this toxic environment.
But the second he is free, he falls into a completely chaotic, destructive lifestyle. If he wanted freedom so badly, why did it instantly seem to destroy him?
Well, it's a fascinating psychological paradox. When you spend your entire adult life inside a highly structured, intensely managed bubble.
Where every hour is scheduled for you.
Exactly. You never develop your own internal guardrails. When John broke free, he lacked those boundaries. His post-Beatles life becomes a masterclass in extreme pendulum swings.
Because he had to test the absolute limits of his freedom.
Precisely.
Okay, that makes so much sense. He's swinging from one extreme to the other, and he starts with extreme emotional purging, with primal therapy in Los Angeles.
Right, which, for those who don't know, is this intense psychological treatment where patients literally scream and wail to release repressed childhood trauma.
And that raw, unfiltered screaming directly shaped the stripped-down sound of his first solo album.
It did. And from there, the pendulum swings outward. He moves to New York in 1971 and transforms into this massive, highly visible political firebrand.
Right.
He becomes so embedded in the anti-war movement that the Nixon administration actually views him as a genuine threat.
Okay, and just to pause here for a quick second, I want to make it super clear to you listening that we aren't taking any political sides here, left or right. We are just impartially reporting what our source material lays out about these historical events.
Absolutely. We're just conveying the ideas contained in the original source material. So according to those sources, the Nixon administration launched a 4-year legal campaign to deport him, calling it a strategic countermeasure against his influence.
Wow. But here's where it gets really interesting and where I have to push back a little on our collective memory.
Oh, how so?
Well, we have this culturally cemented image of John Lennon as this Zen white suit-wearing peace activist softly singing Imagine.
Right.
But how do we reconcile that peaceful legacy with the guy who went through what he called his lost weekend?
Yeah, the lost weekend shatters that Zen image completely. And it wasn't a weekend at all. It was an 18-month separation from Yoko starting in 1973.
18 months.
Yeah. John spent it largely in Los Angeles, New York with his assistant, May Pang. And the psychological mechanism here is pure escapism.
Because he is spiraling into intense, alcohol-fueled debauchery.
Exactly, surrounding himself with enabling friends.
It's unbelievable chaos. I mean, he is hanging out with singer Harry Nilsson, and they are literally getting thrown out of the Troubadour Club in L.A.
Yeah, it got very messy.
There was one incident where John violently heckled the Smothers Brothers during their comedy set until he was physically ejected.
Right.
Another night, he bizarrely places a menstrual pad on his forehead and gets into a scuffle with a waitress. It's just a total lack of control.
It was a very dark period. He even tried to produce Harry Nilsson's album Pussycats, and the sessions were notorious for just being a drunken, chaotic mess.
But the irony of John Lennon is that even in the absolute depths of that chaos, there are these flashes of strange serendipity.
Like the famous bet he made with Elton John.
Oh, this story's incredible. So John records a song called Whatever Gets You Through the Night, and Elton John provides backing vocals and piano. John, in his insecurity, completely doubts the commercial potential of the track.
Yeah.
So he makes a bet with Elton. If the song hits number one, John has to go on stage and perform it live with him.
And of course, the song rockets to number one.
Naturally.
It becomes John's only solo single to top the U.S. Billboard Hot 100 during his lifetime. And true to his word, John honors the bet.
Yes. On Thanksgiving night in 1974.
He makes a surprise, unannounced appearance at Madison Square Garden. The crowd goes absolutely wild. It's an incredible moment of triumph.
And Elton had even just released a cover of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, where he credited John's guitar work under the hilarious pseudonym Dr. Winston O'Boogie.
Yes. But then, just as quickly as he peaked in that rock and roll lifestyle, the pendulum violently swings to the absolute opposite extreme.
Right, because in 1975, his son Sean is born, and John just, he vanishes from public life.
He completely drops out of the music industry. He formalizes a 5-year hiatus to become a house husband.
Which is such a pivot.
It really is. The man who is getting thrown out of LA nightclubs is suddenly waking up at 6 a.m. every single morning in his apartment at the Dakota in New York.
Meticulously planning and cooking meals for his young son, he finds profound peace in pure domesticity.
Which makes the ending so much more tragic.
Yeah, it really does.
Because the Dakota wasn't just a building, it was his sanctuary. It was the physical symbol of his peace and his family life.
And he finally emerges from this hiatus in 1980, releasing the album Double Fantasy, which is just radiating this beautiful fulfillment.
Right. And just weeks later, he is murdered by Mark David Chapman right outside the doors of that very sanctuary. A deeply heartbreaking end to a life defined by such massive extremes.
Single bolt trauma. And it's fascinating to contrast John's trajectory with Paul McCartney's.
Oh, absolutely. Because while John's response to the loss of structure was to embrace total chaos, Paul's reaction was the exact psychological opposite.
A desperate, consuming need for absolute control.
Yes. The panic of the breakup seemed to hit Paul harder than anyone else initially. He retreats to his farm in Scotland and falls into a deep depression.
But his coping mechanism is work.
Exactly. He secretly starts recording his solo debut, McCartney, entirely by himself at his home in London. He is operating under total lockdown.
And that need for control instantly clashes with the rest of the band?
It does. The others realize Paul's solo album is scheduled to come out at the same time as the delayed Let It Be album and Ringo's own solo debut.
Oh, wow.
So they send Ringo, the peacekeeper, to Paul's house to politely ask him to delay his release.
And Paul's reaction is explosive. He literally kicks Ringo out of his home and absolutely refuses to back down.
Which pushes Paul to completely seize the narrative. He decides, if this is ending, I'm going to be the one to end it.
Right. In April 1970, he slips a press release into advanced copies of his album, but it's not a normal press release.
No, it's a Q&A that he wrote himself.
He basically interviews himself to publicly announce that the Beatles are dead.
He had to be the author of his own fate. And that relentless need to prove himself carried right into his next move. Paul formed a new band, Wings, featuring his wife Linda and guitarist Denny Lane.
But he purposefully didn't want to just cash in on his status as a former Beatle. He needed to prove he could build an empire from the dirt up.
Right.
Think about this for a second for everyone listening. Think about a time you've had to prove yourself at a new job. That imposter syndrome is incredibly real.
Oh, definitely.
Now imagine trying to prove yourself when your last job title was member of the Beatles. His response wasn't to rest on his laurels. It's like a modern tech billionaire voluntarily deciding to go back to working out of a dusty garage under an assumed name just to feel the raw hustle again.
That's spot on. Wings books an unannounced university tour. They are literally driving up and down the UK in a van, sleeping in cheap, rundown motels.
Showing up at student unions and getting paid in loose coins collected at the door.
And Paul absolutely refused to play Beatles songs. He forced himself to sweat it out and win the crowd over purely on the merit of his new music.
And that relentless hustle pays massive dividends. Wings achieves unbelievable, staggering heights.
They really do. Their album, Band on the Run, stayed on the UK charts for an astonishing 124 weeks.
And he wrote the theme for the James Bond film Live and Let Die, which was nominated for an Academy Award.
Critics described it as symphonic rock at its absolute peak. And his versatility over the next few decades is simply unmatched.
Yeah, he collaborates with Stevie Wonder on Ebony and Ivory, with Michael Jackson on The Girl Is Mine.
Decades later, he is making music with Kanye West and Rihanna.
He even ventures into classical music, working with composer Carl Davis to produce the full-scale Liverpool Oratorio in 1991.
And he released experimental electronica under the secret pseudonym The Fireman.
He just never, ever stopped working. Even in 2017, he files a massive lawsuit against Sony ATV to finally use a 56-year copyright rule to reclaim his share of the original Lennon-McCartney catalog.
He is the ultimate working musician, managing his own legacy with an iron grip.
So Paul played the pop game and won through sheer volume and control. But then we look at George Harrison.
Right. If Paul dominated the game, George's reaction to freedom was to completely reject the game altogether.
Because George had been creatively suffocated for years. So when the chains came off, he redefined what a solo rock star was even allowed to be.
He opens the floodgates immediately. In 1970, he drops All Things Must Pass. And it's not just a normal album, it's a massive, sprawling triple album.
A total critical and commercial triumph. And it featured this incredibly rich production by Phil Spector.
Yes, Phil Spector utilized his famous wall of sound technique.
Which, for those unfamiliar, is a production style where dozens of instruments, multiple guitars, pianos, horns, are layered over each other in an echo chamber to create this massive, dense roar of music.
Right, it was the complete sonic opposite of the tight, highly arranged studio sound the Beatles were known for. It was George stretching his wings in the biggest way possible.
It featured his massive hit, My Sweet Lord. Though we should note, he was later successfully sued over that song because the melody was nearly identical to the Chiffons' 1963 hit, He's So Fine.
Yeah, the judge actually ruled that George had subconsciously plagiarized it.
But beyond the music itself, George used his newfound platform for something revolutionary. He essentially invented the modern charity mega concert.
It's a monumental achievement. If we connect this to the bigger picture, in 1971, responding to a plea from his friend and mentor, Ravi Shankar, George organized the concert for Bangladesh.
He managed to draw 40,000 people to Madison Square Garden, pulling together a staggering lineup, including Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, and Ringo Starr.
All to raise funds for starving refugees. It laid the direct groundwork for Live Aid a decade later.
But George had zero interest in catering to pop star expectations. If you want proof, just look at his 1974 North American tour, his first since the Beatles. It was widely dubbed the Dark Horse Tour.
Which was a clever play on his album title, Dark Horse, but spelled H-O-A-R-S-E because George was suffering from debilitating laryngitis.
His voice was completely shredded.
But it wasn't just his voice that made fans furious. George fundamentally broke the unwritten contract between the pop star and the audience.
Yeah, people had waited years to hear him play the classics, and instead, he actively antagonized them.
For example, he played the beloved Beatles song, In My Life, but he literally changed the lyrics.
Instead of singing, In My Life, I Love You More, he sang, In My Life, I Love God More.
Right. Imagine being a diehard fan waiting for this nostalgic moment, and instead you get a heavy sermon about Hindu philosophy.
The backlash from critics and fans was so harsh that George essentially refused to tour again until the 1990s.
But there is a brilliant, beautiful irony to George Harrison's life. He was always labeled the quiet Beatle. He was the one who felt the most alienated, marginalized, and bruised by being in a four-man group.
Yet the second he was free, what did he do? He organized the biggest, loudest collaborative charity concert in history. And later, he formed the ultimate collaborative supergroup.
The Traveling Wilburys.
In 1988, he gets together with music legends Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, Roy Orbison, and Jeff Lynne. And instead of parading their massive egos around, they mischievously hide behind ridiculous pseudonyms.
George was Nelson Wilbury and later Spike Wilbury.
Jeff Lynne later explained that it was George's specific idea to, quote, confuse the buggers.
He loved the camaraderie of making music with his friends, but he wanted to entirely strip away the toxic fame that usually came with it.
He found profound healing in spiritual and musical collaboration, which brings us to the final piece of the psychological puzzle Ringo Starr, the heartbeat of the band.
Yes. While George found healing in these grand, egoless collaborations, Ringo's journey is fascinating because he was always the ultimate team player.
So when the team vanished, he initially leaned very heavily on his famous friends to stay afloat, before eventually falling into a very dark abyss.
He starts with a massive charm offensive. His 1973 rock album, simply titled Ringo, is an incredible historical artifact.
Why?
Because it is the only post-breakup record to feature writing and musical contributions from all four former Beatles.
Wow, even though they recorded their parts on entirely separate tracks.
Exactly. Ringo's sheer likability managed to pull them all onto one record. And it worked. He had massive solo hits like Photograph and It Don't Come Easy.
But that momentum didn't, and maybe couldn't last. Despite those early hits, Ringo candidly admits that he eventually just stopped caring about the music.
He and The Who's drummer, Keith Moon, formed a notorious drinking club in Los Angeles called the Hollywood Vampires.
Ringo later spoke about his severe addiction during this era, openly stating, "Years I've lost.
Yeah.
Absolute years. I lived in a blackout."
It was a terrifying descent. As the addiction took hold, his record label contracts were dropped, his albums completely failed to chart.
And he had to lean heavily into acting and television just to maintain a profile.
Right. Most notably, he became the beloved narrator for the children's series Thomas and Friends and played Mr. Conductor on Shining Time Station.
So what does this all mean? I want to ask you about this, because we look at Ringo, and he wasn't the primary visionary songwriter like John or Paul, and he wasn't the fiery spiritual seeker like George.
No, he wasn't.
But I have to wonder, was Ringo's high emotional intelligence and his sheer undeniable likability actually his greatest superpower? Did that save his life?
I strongly believe it did. That deep emotional intelligence eventually gave him the grace to stop running and face his demons.
In October 1988, he and his wife, actress Barbara Bach, checked themselves into a detox clinic in Arizona.
He fully embraced sobriety, and that clarity allowed him to return to what he did best, bringing people together. He used his superpower to launch Ringo Starr and his all-star band.
Which is such a brilliant concept. He created a completely supportive touring family of famous musicians where everyone checks their ego at the door.
And they all take turns playing their hits. He essentially found a way to make touring a communal, joyous, safe experience again, completely free from the toxic pressure cooker that destroyed the Beatles.
Exactly. He built a supportive community he had lost.
And honestly, that brings this entire fascinating history directly back to you listening right now. Why should you, in your life today, care about the post-1970 lives of these four specific musicians? Because every single one of us faces moments where a defining chapter of our lives suddenly and irrevocably ends.
It could be losing a job you thought you'd retire from, the bitter end of a long relationship, or a massive geographic move that strips away your identity.
It's the terrifying blank page of starting over.
Exactly. And the aftermath of the Beatles provides four incredibly distinct blueprints for how to navigate that blank page.
You have John's blueprint, radical, sometimes chaotic reinvention, and pushing your boundaries until you find your peace.
You have Paul's blueprint, a relentless head-down work ethic to prove your worth and regain control.
George's blueprint, rejecting the old rules entirely to seek deeper spiritual meaning and define success on your own terms.
And Ringo's blueprint, relying on vulnerability, community, and resilience to survive the dark times.
It's an incredibly powerful way to view their legacies.
It really is. And it leaves me with one final thought for you to mull over as we wrap up. Culturally, we are so conditioned to view the breakup of the Beatles as this great mournful tragedy.
We constantly lament the music they never made together in the 1970s.
But I want you to think about the sheer diversity of what they actually achieved independently. Without the breakup, we never get John's raw, agonizing Primal Therapy albums.
We never get Paul pioneering experimental electronica and classical oratorios.
We never get George inventing the template for the global charity mega concert.
And we never get Ringo building a blueprint for sober communal touring.
When you look at the sheer breadth of what they contributed to the world apart, is it possible that breaking up was actually the greatest artistic gift they could have ever given us?
It certainly shattered the fairy tale we all wanted. But what grew out of those shattered pieces was so much more complex, deeply human, and enduring.
I think that's a beautiful place to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us at the table for this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep questioning the narratives you've been handed, and we'll see you next time as we look for the next mountain waiting to be climbed.